You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, fantasy football's back. DraftKings.com. If you think you know your football, well, put your money where your mouth is because you can win enormous cash prizes. All right, and you get a free entry into the Millionaire Maker event. First place takes home $1 million. You can finally, I don't know how far $1 million goes nowadays, but you can't buy a yacht. Well, you can, actually. You can even buy a plane, but good luck, you know, trying to fill it with fuel. The point is $1 million goes a long way. You can give it to charity. You can buy that Tesla. I'd hire a cook. Head to DraftKings.com, enter promo code Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, to play free, become a millionaire. DraftKings.com, bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. Again, my last name, C-A-L-L-E-N, DraftKings.com. Now back to the show.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Brian Callen Show. Brian isn't able to make it, but we will be having a special celebrity guest in the last 15 minutes of the interview. Wonder who it could be. Today we have on the show Caitlin Doughty. Is that how you pronounce it?
Doughty. But Doughty. You know, whatever.
Doughty. Like,
I know who you're talking about.
Like Princess Diana's boyfriend.
Exactly. Yeah. Bread dough t-shirt is what I say.
And she's the author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is, well, it's a lot of things. But I mean, you know, it really starts off with your experiences working in a crematorium. Talks about death and then talks about how we've lost touch with death and the consequences of that for our society.
That's a pretty good sum up.
There you go. There you go. I think one of the things that I really enjoyed, you know, just as a writer about the book is that you do such a good job of starting with sort of like, here's this fun world. Let's explore it. Let's understand, you know, like all of the crazy things that surround death, and then, you know, really did a nice, nice slow roll into like, oh, and this is not just a fun, sensational book. I actually really have a point, and this is something that's really relevant and that you have to face because facing death is not comfortable for us.
Thank you. That was the idea. The stories are kind of the gateway drug that gets you into it and gets you a little more comfortable hearing about it, and then I try and sneak in under the radar all the history and the philosophy stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, first, why don't we just talk about like death? Like, death is not a comfortable topic.
Right. I think that's all I'm really qualified to talk about. So I hope that's what we're talking about today.
And I thought one of the things that was really interesting. So why don't we just start at the beginning, right? What's your real first exposure to death that you talk about in the book?
Well, I saw when I was younger, I was about 8 years old, I saw a young girl fall off a mall balcony to what I assume was her death. And it was incredibly traumatic for me. I developed all sorts of OCD tendencies around it because we live in a culture now where young children are hidden from death and adults are hidden from death for that matter. And when you don't have exposure to something, you can absolutely turn it into the boogeyman, which is what I did.
Right, and which is what we've all done. And I mean, I think, you know, you did a great job of providing sort of what was the historical experience of death. Like, if you're living in Europe during the Black Death, you see a lot of death.
Well, even if you were living in America 100 years ago, you saw a lot of death. You saw your 3 out of 6 of your siblings die before they were 5, and you saw your mom die, and you probably didn't have much in the way of grandparents because they would be dead already. And that's just not our experience anymore. People can go until age 40, age 50 without even going to a funeral.
Right. And so there's a real, I mean, you know, people living in earlier centuries had a real awareness that death was the fate for all of us and that it was, you know, I mean, you talked a lot about some of the sort of historical perspectives on that. The thing that, you know, I always think about because my mother was an art historian is really Vanitas paintings, right? Mm-hmm. Where you always have a painting and it's always like beautiful, fresh fruit and life and all that sort of stuff. But then always, you know, sitting on the table is a giant ass skull.
Right. The fly in the ointment. Your enjoyment. That's why I love Vanitas paintings as well, because it's such a good representation of in the midst of life we are in death. Mm-hmm. And all those beautiful fruits and all those beautiful flowers will also decay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not any source of life is also the back end of it is death and decay. And
right.
That's not a bad thing. That's what creates new life.
Yeah, and one of the things that you even talked about in the, I mean, from purely from a biological perspective, right, all of those nutrients are recycled, right? And you talked about the Ethiopian fishermen who, you know, put their dead back into the lake so that the nutrients can return. And that's probably ultimately good for their fish yield. But also in a psychological sense, right, you talk about this emotional awakening that happens for you as you become more and more comfortable with death, which, you know, I mean, I've seen pictures of you online. You know, you used to have sort of natural colored hair. Now it seems like you've dyed your hair black.
Well, I've been dyeing my hair black since I was like 16.
That's
a long-standing development in my hair.
Because that's part of what we think of when we think of people who think about death a lot is, you know, it's very goth, like, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Yeah.
You know what's interesting is that about half the people say, oh my God, like, you're not an old white man in a suit. You're completely different than I expected. And then the other half say, of course you have black hair and bangs. You're exactly what I expect from a girl who thinks about death.
Right.
So you're always going to get one or the other. You're either the last thing you would think of or the first thing you would think of.
Right. But I think that can you talk about that emotional reawakening that happens for you over the course of the book, especially over that first year at West Wind where you're working at that crematorium?
Well, when you really are exposed to death, and more specifically exposed to dead bodies and the reality of the physical aspect of death, what it did for me was made me realize how much more connected to the world I was and how much more connected to being an animal I was, because we have this sense that humans are at the top of the pyramid and that we are animal plus, we are animal special of some kind. And we are different from most animals in the sense that we know our own mortality and we know that we're going to die in the way an antelope, for instance, doesn't. He just sees a lion and then, oh, well, it's another lion, and then goes back to his day. But we have to realize that we are animals and we are just food for worms, and we can just lie where we die, and we're not nature's super special favorites. And that opinion is what has led to a lot of really negative things in our culture, I would argue, including climate change, including our fear of aging, including our inability to just let people die when they want to die.
Would you mind breaking some of those down? Because I don't think the connection between us being dishonest about the fact that we're going to die and climate change is probably obvious for most people.
Right. Well, I think it's a sense of your place in the universe and your place as an animal and the idea of what we've done to the earth and the intensity of the things that we've built. And there's a lot of argument that the fact that we build buildings and the fact that we build factories are all death denial mechanisms. They're mechanisms to say, we've figured this out. We can subvert death by building and by creating and by having these very tangible things. But that's just a sign of not being comfortable with our own deaths.
Well, I mean, so what you're saying is that essentially human exceptionalism, human thinking that the rules don't necessarily apply to them, or sort of pushing that to the side, leads us to think that, you know, the rules don't apply to us in terms of the rules of, you know, how climate works, how greenhouse gases work, how all of that sort of stuff. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And when you don't see dead bodies and you don't see any physical representations of death, it's pretty easy to believe that the rules don't apply to you because there's no immediate evidence to you that they do.
And you're not aware of the fragility of life, the fragility of the ecosystem, all of that stuff.
No. And as we continue, even with our dead bodies, we chemically preserve them. We put formaldehyde in them. We smooth out their skin through dermatological fillers post-mortem. Mm-hmm. We put makeup on them. Mm-hmm. We don't let them look like dead bodies. We don't make them look like something that is fragile and old and dead, which most dead bodies are. So if we can't even accept that in death, how are we supposed to accept it in our own lives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think part of what you also do is talk about the sort of the benefit of running from death, in the sense that, you know, you talk about going on a date and, you know, the guy you were on a date with was, you know, really like running from his own mortality and wishes that he could live forever and had become a biologist because of it. But that what he didn't realize was that fear of mortality was a large part of what was driving him to work so hard. So, yes, you know, building factories and building skyscrapers and, you know, painting great works of art may be a way to try and cheat death in some sense, but surely humanity and society has benefited from a certain amount of trying to deny death.
Absolutely. And there's no, I think that what people should realize is that that denial of death, and this is from Ernest Becker, whose book Denial of Death is one of the most fantastic books ever written, in my opinion, with the idea that, yes, all of these great works of humanity are from this secret sense of wanting immortality and wanting to be a hero and wanting to deny death a little bit through a work that continues on. Mm-hmm. Having children falls into that same category. And it is this drive that, I mean, for me, doing this whole project and my advocacy absolutely is driven by an immortality drive. Mm-hmm. And absolutely is driven by a little bit wanting to deny that once I'm gone, I'm gone, and I will have made no impact.
Right.
So it's not necessarily trying to say that that isn't true. In fact, quite the opposite. It's saying realize that that's true and mm-hmm. be a little more self-aware about the role that death is playing in your life and the things that you're doing.
Right. So that, you know, you have an appropriate relationship with it rather than just a reactionary relationship with it.
Exactly.
And if anything, that you can really harness it to, because that's the thing, when you're honest about your feelings, when you're honest about what's going on with them, you, then you can really harness those drives to be even more productive. So, I mean, you know, maybe your follow-up book is, you know, a business book about how you channel your fear of death, your death drive to, like, you know.
I would love to read that book.
Yeah, boost fourth quarter profits.
Yeah, I would absolutely love to read that book. Because those building buildings and having children and creating art, those things aren't bad. Those things are what set humanity apart.
Mm-hmm.
And they are humanity and the foundation of humanity in many ways. But we're not doing them as responsibly and awarely, not a word, self-aware as we should be, because we're not acknowledging where that drive is coming from.
Yeah, the dictionary here on the Brian Callen Show, even when Brian Callen, and especially when Brian Callen isn't around, is expansive. We include and welcome all words, you know.
I just feel like we're not as awarely about the world. I'm feeling very awarely today.
I'm getting flashbacks to the Bush administration.
Yeah, exactly. I represent that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's a, okay, so... So really, the point is not to say that, you know, we should just be totally comfortable with death, because as human beings, that's probably never going to happen. It's just
no,
yeah,
that's not the goal at all. That's
right.
Not the goal at all. And it's the idea is to try and work towards becoming comfortable with death, realizing that new challenges are going to pop up every week.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be something that puts that idea back into your head. Maybe you fall in love. Maybe you get a new job. Maybe you start a new project, and all of a sudden, oh shit, here's a reason that I can't die anymore. Or here's a reason that I'm now uncomfortable a little more with my own death, because I want to stay around here and be in love, or I want to stay around and finish this, or I have a mm-hmm. child now. So it's a constant evolving relationship that you have with death, but you should have a relationship with death.
And because, you know, recognizing your own mortality makes you cherish life all the more.
It does, yeah. And there's a way that it's good for society, and there's also absolutely a way that it's good in kind of a self-helpy way.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I'm really excited about this. I see like a whole weekend retreat in Hawaii, since you're already from there. You know, it can be Tony Robbins style, right?
Oh,
but
man.
Instead of, you know, walking across the hot coals, you have to wash a dead body.
I would love that. I would love to open with like the Tony Robbins beach balls flying through the crowd kind of thing too. And I run out with my little Britney Spears concert headset. And just go, who is ready to face your mortality?
That's right. That's
and
right.
And then we go to a lava field and wash a body. And I'm all for it. If anybody would like to fund this.
Listen,
I
think it's 100%. A really, really good idea. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I mean, listen, what is Tony Robbins talking about? He's talking about, like, unleashing the giant within. Well,
mm-hmm.
guess what? You know, the Sistine Chapel, you know, was not painted because, you know, he had, you know, unleash the giant within. No, it was mortality. It was death that drove him to do that.
Yep. Hey, you need to. You're great. You need to join the movement right now. I'm going to sign you. I'm putting you on the email list.
No, I'm really excited. I'm really excited for, you know, like, I mean, there's a whole Reaper theme. Like, there's already such great imagery around death. Like, you know, you can really, there's a lot you can do. But I think, you know, it's all about making that business book.
Okay. All right. I'm writing this down as soon as we get off the phone.
Good.
I mean, in those industries, that's where you need it most, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we need it, you know, on Wall Street, on in these businesses that have a real effect on the larger world, better for better or for worse. Those are the people who really need the kick in the pants about their own mortality.
Are you saying that investment bankers aren't emotionally self-aware?
I believe I am saying that. I'm going to go ahead and stand by that claim.
That is amazing. That is amazing.
I'm going to go ahead and put that out there with all the sincerity in the world.
So you hint at this in the book, right? But there's now a lot of people who are really trying to cheat death, who really believe that immortality is available in our lifetime. We interviewed Aubrey de Grey, who, is trying to basically extend human life. You know, Ray Kurzweil, who wrote The Singularity Is Near, thinks he's going to live forever. There are a lot of people. I mean, the dreams of immortality are old, but now, rather than being hitched up to the philosopher's stone and the elixir of life, they're hitched up to science. That, you know, now science is going to make it possible. The human body is just a machine, and we can fix the machine so that it lasts forever. What do you think are the consequences? Let's imagine that they succeed. What do you think are the consequences of that for society?
I think that there are quite a few consequences, and especially because, you know, guess who we're starting with? We're starting with privileged men, mostly white men, who want to live forever, not everybody, but mostly them. And they're pretty mm-hmm. open about that in everything that I've read and interviews that I've seen. They're very open about, hey, this is for me. I personally want to live forever. I'm not doing this to help children in the third world. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this to help me, as a man of great privilege and wealth, continue to live my life of great privilege and wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think is a pretty negative premise to start from.
Mm-hmm.
I also think the issue is that we are already pretty desperate for the resources to care for the people that we have. Because this really radical extension in life that's happened just naturally with medicalization in the past 10 years, 20 years, the life extension has caused a situation where as the baby boomers get older, we don't have the resources to take care of them.
Well, we have to distinguish between life extension for, you know, where the quality of life is, you know, deteriorating and the person is not actually able to care for themselves. And because a lot of these people think that they're actually going to be able to reverse aging and that essentially you would live out the rest of your life as a 30-year-old or a 20-year-old or something like that.
Right, which is they're really far from that.
Yes,
they
no, I
really
agree.
They're really far from having that be the case. And all of this talk about wanting to extend life, I think, leads much more to that first scenario
mm-hmm.
than it does to the happy 20-year-old utopia that they're thinking about.
But I think that's the thing is that obviously we understand the consequences of, you know, a bunch of, you know, a zombie army of the shuffling, you know, undead, you
but
know.
But I don't know that people do understand the consequences of that because we're still able to ignore it largely, and people do. They do ignore it. We are able to shuffle them off into nursing homes and places where they can't be seen and can't distress us with their dementia and their low quality of life. And this is going to lead to more of that. I think I don't mean to sound, you know, conspiracy doomsday at all, but I think that by having a very sleek Silicon Valley version of life extension, we're ignoring the fact that we're not taking care of the people that we have.
Well, and not only that we can't afford to take care of the people that we have, right?
No, I mean, not by a long shot.
Right.
And there are a lot of people who speak about it, who know what they're talking about, who are in gerontology and in end-of-life care, who speak about it the way some climate scientists speak about it, which is basically, it's too late.
Yeah.
We'll do what we can, but we've already made it irreversibly difficult for ourselves.
Well, and not only that, I mean, you know, I can't remember the exact statistic, but in whatever, you know, Thomas Friedman's book, That Used to Be Us, he talks about how something like half of all medical expenses are on the last 6 months of life.
More than that, yeah. I think, yeah. And we're doing things like putting pacemakers in 90-year-olds
mm-hmm.
and just keeping people alive even though they have severe dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And these things that nobody ever thinks that they want, but even if they sign a document saying, I don't want any intervention, when it comes down to it, there are all of these things that can override it. And there's not a good palliative care system, which is just trying to make people comfortable as opposed to intervene aggressively.
So, and I know that this was slightly a fiction of Fox News or entirely a fiction of Fox News, but how do you feel about death panels?
I am pro death panels. I am very pro death panels, because what death panels are is just having Medicare fund a doctor to have an honest end-of-life conversation with an older patient.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, we're going to sit down for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. We're going to go over these documents. I'm going to ask you what it is you want. And the person can say, I want everything done possible.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be on a ventilator. I don't care how much it costs. You can say that, and that mm-hmm. was what will go in your documents.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also say, you know what, I've been thinking about this, and I don't want to be kept alive longer than I am comfortable
mm-hmm.
and healthy. And please do everything you can to make sure I go out on a high, quick, painless note.
But a large part of this is, you know, human psychology, right? It's availability, heuristics, and all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, if you there may be, you know, 90% of cases where, you know, you make the right decision, and rather than like indefinitely drawing out what ends up being a miserable last 6 months of life, right, the ones that we remember are, you know, the one case of somebody whose life was terminated prematurely, who could have survived, or, you know, where you can create that narrative. Like, we don't feel the situations equally.
Right, which is a shame, because I, you know, and I'm not going to make any really strong comparisons here, but I will say that there is a horror to life extended beyond what is comfortable for the
mm-hmm.
person. And we should be, and people who witness that, witness a really terrible death, will come around pretty quickly to the side of, let's talk more about end of life, let's make sure this doesn't happen again,
mm-hmm.
because they don't want to watch, they don't want anybody have to watch what they had to watch with their mother or their spouse and what they went through at the end of their life when it was extended beyond what anybody was comfortable with.
And I think the interesting thing is that, you know, there are also consequences to that. Like, you know, this is L.A., so there are lots of people who are in alternative medicine. But I know a lot of people who essentially saw, you know, a loved one go through some sort of horrific chemo experience that didn't extend life, didn't improve quality of life or anything like that. And, you know, that leads to a sort of reaction against the medical community, and then they run away from it more than is appropriate.
Right. Yeah, we don't want that either. We
mm-hmm.
want chemo to, you know, it's absolutely, if I got cancer right now, as much as I hate the drastic end of life, I would probably be like, sign me up.
Yeah.
Let's do this. I'm 30. Let's
mm-hmm.
you know, make this happen. And those should be very available. But I actually spoke to a doctor friend of mine who argued that, you know, they're overusing these medical technologies, but at the same time, that's what gets all of these drugs and technologies funded,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that they're being overused.
Absolutely.
And that's hard, you know, so then if I'm 30, would this technology not be available if it wasn't funded by it being overused in older people? And I don't know where I'm certainly not a medical ethicist, I don't know where the line is there, but certainly something to think about.
Yeah, and I mean, but regardless, it's something that has to be thought about. And I think that the issue is that I think for a lot of issues that we deal with in society, we're too much allowing ourselves to have these conversations emotionally,
mm-hmm.
Rather than stepping back, understanding our feelings, and then really being able to sort through that. And then, you know, also, I mean, you know, it has to be an engagement of both reason and emotion, right? In terms of also the emotion of seeing a loved one go through this horrible, you know, I mean, you talk about your grandmother in the book. I mean, would you mind sharing that?
Sure. Or it has to be an engagement, period.
Yeah.
You can't just put your head in the sand because
mm-hmm.
you don't want to talk about death.
Right.
My grandmother had subdural hematoma. She fell and hit her head and had a brain bleed, essentially. And it it gave her pretty severe dementia, and that dementia went on for years and years and years. And if it was, you know, a 10, 20, 30 years ago, she probably would have just died because there wouldn't have been the immediate operative technologies to fix it as well as it was able to. And there were several times that she could have died. She got a really bad infection. And we did everything we could, or my parents did everything they could to save her and just to live her, give her back to her life as full-on, completely checked out of the building.
Yeah.
And she was a very dignified woman in her life, and I doubt that that's what she would have wanted. But I don't know in the medical community if that conversation was even on the table.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, that's the thing, just in terms of what your memory of the, your grandmother is, there are now really like two grandmothers probably in your memory.
Absolutely. And my grandfather also had Alzheimer's for many years. So I have the grandparents that I grew up with who lived down the block from me. And then I have the grandparents of my adulthood from 15 on, because my grandfather got Alzheimer's, had it for about 7 years, then died. Then shortly after, my grandmother had this subdural hematoma, and then she had dementia for the next years. So it's basically been, you know, 10, 15 years of them turning into completely different people.
And I mean, in a certain sense, your memory of them being tainted and, you know, being ruined, essentially.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's no argument from my end of they should have died immediately. You know, that's not what I'm saying at all. But there was a lot of medical intervention that happened that if we know their, for a fact that their mind was totally gone, if something else goes wrong with their heart or with infections or whatever, maybe it's okay to let that take its course.
Right. Right. But again, you know, it's again, so much of that is that then that availability, right? Where we start instantly running to the worst case scenarios of that, where, you know, somebody wants an inheritance. And so, you know, they use that as a justification to not resuscitate or to not treat that or whatever it is. I mean, but I think that so much of it, again, is it's awareness of death. It's awareness of all of these things, but it's also awareness of our own psychology.
Well, I would say that that's why the medical establishment needs to be involved in a healthier way. Mm. The medical establishment needs to feel like they are allowed to do those things and help with those things and judge the situation accordingly. And if they feel like there's something untoward or the person has dementia and the family is doing something for, you know, not the greatest reason, being able to deal with that on a case-by-case basis and not having it be universally we have to intervene because our own failure is such a fear for us.
One of the things that Brian and I also talked about with your book, which I thought was really interesting, is, you know, essentially you talk about certain rituals that, you know, human cultures have had for a very long time that we've now stripped away, right? Like washing the body before it's buried or burned or whatever it may be, right? You know, the process of the laying out of the body so that, you know, people sit with the body. And now, you know, usually like all sort of historical rituals, they at the time were justified in the only terms that people could justify them, you know, thousands of years ago, which was something superstitious, right? That process, you know, over those 3 days, the soul leaves the body or whatever it may be. And now we understand the superstitious part of that. And so throw out the ritual, right? But what we don't understand is that there may have actually been real psychological and emotional benefits to that ritual, that in throwing out that ritual, we have now left ourselves without the tools to be able to properly grieve and deal with the death.
I think that's a really excellent characterization of it. We are increasingly secular. We know that. We have the data for it. And people who have a really intense religious understanding of death, they believe the soul is going a certain place, they believe the body has meaning, they believe the wake has meaning, they know how to grieve. That's fantastic. You know, they have all of that on lock. Carry on as you were. But for people who are secular or irreligious or just vaguely spiritual, there needs to be something, because we're built for community and we're built for ritual. And even if we detach that from religion, there's still a need to transition somehow, to make that really tangible. This person who is a very big part of your life is no longer a part of your life. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And just having the body disappear or go be cremated and nobody sees it and maybe the ashes come back to you at a certain time, that's not ritual. So I think it's absolutely possible to divorce ritual from religion.
Also, that's the other thing, too. I mean, have you ever read the work of Jonathan Haidt?
I haven't, no.
You might really enjoy his stuff. And I mean, you know, he would also probably be able to point you in the direction. But it seems to me that, you know, there probably should be research done on an empirical and scientific basis about, you know, what are the psychological benefits of some of these rituals? You know, mm-hmm. what, like, if you had a control group that didn't wash the body and then compared it to a control group that did, like, how are they then 6 months out?
I totally agree. And just, and what's a shame is that I have all of this just anecdotal evidence.
Yeah.
But I know that's not what an argument is based on, especially
right.
in this culture. And I can tell you that everybody that I've talked to who has had some kind of home funeral and been involved with care for the body, I've never had anybody tell me, oh, it was gross. Oh, I wish I hadn't done it. Pretty universally, they say, man, that really was a powerful thing that really changed my relationship to the death itself and to grieving. And they say that, but I don't know if those are people who are self-selecting, who would have done it, been willing to do it anyway. I don't know how we can actually compare that, again, to real data from another group. And I would love, and there's some people doing research on death awareness, which is fantastic, but I would love more people to be doing research on the actual interaction with ritual and death.
Well, and I mean, also seeing, I mean, I think that's the thing is, you know, there, you say that's how we, you know, how you build an argument in this culture. Well, there are good reasons why we rely on empiricism, you know, because it is very easy to anecdotally have these feelings about one thing or another, but you know, I don't, part of the problem I think is that we have so much great empirical research and then we don't use it. Anyway, I mean, there's a whole separate conversation there, but, you know, also to find out exactly like which rituals confer which benefits, like what is the difference between a laying out? What is the period of laying out that is most beneficial? What are the consequences, for example, of embalming? Like what does that do psychologically to a person? Because if you had an article that said, you know, when you embalm a body like 6 months out, you know, people are less, they have less come to terms with the loss of their loved ones or whatever else it may be. Well, that's the sort of thing that would force the funeral industry to respond.
Yeah, you were speaking to my deepest desires here because I argue all these things, and I do come from a pretty secular scientific viewpoint on the things that I do, and a lot of the people who work in the same advocacy as me come at it from a very spiritual place.
Right.
And that's wonderful, but I don't think that that's going to have the same impact on larger culture and is going to get people as much to say, oh, okay, I can see very real tangible, proven benefits from this in quite the way that they need. So I really hope that that is the next step and that I can convince people to do that. And if you are listening right now and have access to scientific or educational institutions, you know, call me.
Well, I mean, listen, I mean, we've interviewed John Haidt before. I'll set you guys up on an email.
That'd be wonderful.
And then, yeah, but I mean, that's the thing. Like, it just needs to be articulated. And I think the part of what you're also talking about is a lot of the people who are in the movement come at it from a spiritual standpoint. And just from an anthropological standpoint, as soon as people start talking about energy and, you know, the soul
chakras.
And all that, and chakras and whatever, the medical community is not going to listen. So you have to, you know, have it in the terms that they understand.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to alienate those people because they're doing incredible work. But from my perspective, I think that the very basic act of interacting with the body and having it at the home, you can have that in a very secular way, and then you could also paste anything on top of that religiously or culturally that you wanted to. But the template should be essentially a-religious.
Now, Caitlin, I have some very exciting news.
Oh, you do?
We've brought in a very, very special guest. He's a big celebrity.
Huge celebrity.
Does
huge.
A lot of
I'm a
television.
Sometimes working actor. I have very small parts in huge films like The Hangover and Hangover 2.
Oh, my God. It's Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Callen.
Brian Callen on The Brian Callen Show.
Caitlin.
Oh, my God. God, I can't believe this. This is incredible.
I know. I probably, my voice is rather hypnotic, so.
You can't, I'm crying a little bit right now.
One tear traipsing down your cheek. That's what I like to hear. Caitlin, I loved your book.
Thank you.
Can I call you Caitlin?
You can very much call me Caitlin, yes.
Do you pronounce your last name Doty?
Yes.
I fucked it up.
Your
you got
partner
it right.
in crime did not get that correct on the first try.
Damn it, Hunter.
I have to call him out for that, but you nailed it.
Caitlin Doty. Well, when I was reading this book, I looked at my wife and I said, I'm reading a book by a mortician. And it's pretty damn good. And my wife is obsessed with all things macabre. And she goes, I can't read that book. I go, oh, you can and you will. And so
I like the creepy, serious voice you use. That's how you get people to do things.
I know. And she was eyeing. She kept wanting, dying for me to say, it's not that good. And every time I'd get to, she'd see me like I'm halfway through. And she was like, well. And I was like, it gets better. Just teasing her, just dangling a piece of meat in front of a dog. So she's it's in her hand as we speak. I've never read a book like this, and I don't know, you write so well, which I'm sure you never get tired of hearing, because I think this is your first book. Am I right?
It is. Yeah. No, that's great news. Thank you.
Well, it is. You're an excellent writer, because I guess you have this ability to put, I feel like as the reader, I identify with you so strongly. The way you kind of talk about crying for no reason, hunched over your 13th century, the books on 13th century France and things like that, and just being obsessed or just interested at least in that period, medieval Europe and what went on back then, and trying to find a job. All those things that you kind of made, you made it very, very personal.
And the idea is kind of that I can be your person who's holding your hand through this. And I was a complete, I had no idea what I was doing. I was derping around. I was messing up. I was too emotionally involved. And that all of those reactions when you first start dealing with death are totally normal. And you should not be, you shouldn't feel like it's supposed to be this beautiful, elegant, linear process to become more comfortable with death. It's a messy, weird, bizarre, surreal process, and that's totally okay.
Well, you talk in the book about how you probably want to be buried just with a shroud, a biodegradable shroud, into the earth, so it's basically, creates better fertilizer. Do you still feel that way?
I absolutely feel that way. I call it corpse ground hole dump. So just dig a hole, shroud me, and put me in. And or even maybe no shroud, maybe just straight into the ground. Because I like the idea of very much, for me it's really comforting to think of myself as just going straight back into the universe. Because as a secular person, I don't have a lot of meaning for my soul. So the only meaning I derive is the idea of biologically my body being useful, my atoms being shot back out into the universe and having some sort of purpose beyond me.
Would you want a tombstone or not?
No, I don't think so. I like the idea of my body disappearing, but disappearing in a way that it's a beautiful landscape. So if my friends and family want to come and sit by the tree near my grave or want to just sit in this lovely surrounding as a park, they could certainly do that. But I don't have a need for a forever Caitlin Doty etched in big letters on a tombstone.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if when you are buried that way, do your bones stay intact for, 100 years? Or
that's covered in Hamlet.
No, they don't. They...
That's covered.
What did you say?
Because
that's covered in Hamlet. The grave digger goes through this pretty extensively in the Yorick scene.
No, but when you find that they exhume mass graves and things, they'll find, bits of bone and skeletons and things.
Read Hamlet. Sorry. Read it more closely.
I'm talking to Caitlin Doty.
I did not write Hamlet. I just want to let you know.
May as well have.
You wrote the Hamlet of our time.
Exactly.
I'm gonna blurb that on the paperback edition
by Brian Callen. The Hamlet of our time.
That's
right. The sometimes working actor.
So anyway, yes, Brian's question's a good one, and I shouldn't have interrupted, and I'm sorry.
Yes, they decompose or they turn to dust. Not as quickly as they're definitely the last thing to go, and it takes a lot longer, but they do. Mm. And in a mass grave, it's a lot of bone on bone. So it will take longer, but if it's your single bone in the right kind of soil, it happens.
And that's why it's more effective if you're doing a mass grave. One of the things you cover in the book is to do a human body dirt lasagna.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Dirt on dirt. So they knew what they were doing with plague bodies. Yeah. They had seen it before.
Yeah. I remember watching and seeing my grandfather. They had an open casket for him, and it was the strangest thing in the world. And I did some research on what embalming really was. And I remember I was probably 20, and I was like, well, not going to be me. I'm definitely going to get cremated or something where I can be scattered about. But I guess it does feel like when you're put in the earth, you are going to be – I like that idea very much as well, just because I feel like you're – as you're decomposed, a million or a zillion different organisms are eating you and then going on their merry way to create other forms of life, whether it's a plant or whatever it might be.
Right. It's really comforting for me. And some people have that thought and think it's absolutely horrific. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing they can imagine is being eaten by worms, or the worst thing they can imagine is being burned in a crematory.
Well, do you?
And it's really about just figuring out what brings you some sort of comfort when you think about your demise.
Well, I did also think what you said about just how much energy is required to cremate a body.
Right.
How much is it?
It's a lot. It's there's a lot of natural gas used. I think it's the equivalent of a 500-mile car trip.
Wow.
Is one of the pieces of data. It releases mercury into the environment. Mm. It's not the most environmentally friendly thing, which we think it is. It's better than traditional burial. It's better than the formaldehyde and the big casket and the vault and the headstone and all of that. But it's not as good as just opening a hole in the ground.
I really appreciated how dignified, or at least how you, especially with the babies, when you would unwrap them from the blue plastic to look at them, because you felt like you needed to look at them to at least acknowledge that they were human and that they had been here, or maybe not, but they were little creatures that you, little human beings, and you were kind of giving them, I guess, in some way, in the best way you could, a voice or some recognition. I wonder if, as you saw all these different people come in, and usually you would find out how they died, or sometimes you wouldn't, did it get you thinking about how you would want to die?
Absolutely. And it made me think that I didn't want to just go to some random funeral home worker, because that's what I could have as much respect as I wanted for these babies and for these people who had died, but that I still wasn't their family. Mm. I still wasn't someone who had an emotional relationship with them. So to have it just be me with them when they died never really seemed quite right to me.
Yeah, yeah.
So definitely made me think that I hope that when I die, it's not some random guy hosing me off in the mortuary, that it's my family.
Did you find, and do you find, having worked with bodies and seeing how, like, just democratic death is, you know, no matter what you do in your life, he's coming for all of us, and you talk about that in the book. Did you find at times a sense of malaise, or sort of what's the point of it all anyway? We're all going to end up here, so why try? Did you ever have to battle that kind of stuff?
Yes, absolutely. I'm actually being called because they're
the radio interview.
Need me? I'm doing a radio interview.
Go do your thing.
Be a big star. Be a big star.
Caitlin Doughty.
I'm just really overscheduled for today. I'm overscheduled. This was such fabulous questions, though. Thank you so much.
Well, we love the book, and we will push it on our website.
And anytime you want to come back when things have cooled down, we're here.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you so much.
And go do your thing. Have a great interview, and we will continue to talk about your book and you as right now.
Thank you so much, guys. I hope that was an okay place to edit it.
Perfect.
It was
okay.
Great.
We're going to record all of this. This will be part of the outtake.
I can't wait to share it. Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, Caitlin.
Bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen,
There it was. I think I really brought the interview.
You did, actually. Like, I was amazing. I was just watching you and being like, yeah. God, he's so good.
Yeah.
It really gives me something to aspire to.
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that the minute I show up and I start speaking into the mic, a lot of people say, you know what, Bri? I realize everything's going to be okay. That's kind of what they do. Women tend to ovulate. I've heard that. I don't want to say. It's just that apparently my voice causes all kinds of hormonal reactions in both men and women.
Brian, is it true that you're starting a fertility clinic where you just come in and speak to the woman's womb and then she ovulates a lot?
Well,
then...
I was doing a show in Irvine. I'll answer that question this way. And I was sweating a lot. And I sweat when I'm on stage because I give 110%. I give 110% when I'm on stage. I like to give it to my audience. I give it hard. And I had to reach down my front row, and I stole a woman's napkin, and I dabbed my man juice off, and I put it on her table, and I said, "Careful now, you touch that, you might get pregnant." And apparently, the audience thought that was funny. I was being dead serious. I don't know why suddenly I'm talking this way. We're just having a conversation about death, and now I'm sudden. I almost sound like the Marlboro Man or something. My voice, I'm getting sound like I'm from the West. All right, kids. This has been Brian Callen and Hunter Motz. My thanks to Mike Casentini, who's producing this right now and watching our voices kind of graft across the computer. That's all for now. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.